Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
At Lowe's, this Veterans Day and every day, verified military members, veterans, and their spouses get automatic silver status in MyLowe's Rewards with free standard shipping, plus 10% off eligible purchases with no annual limit. It's one way we honor and give back to those who have served and still do. Learn more now at Lowe's.com/military. 10% discount can't be combined with another offer. Exclusions, terms, and conditions apply. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Subject to change.
The Deadfoot Diver Podcast with Kurt the Deadfoot Diver.
Welcome to the Deadfoot Diver Podcast, where we talk about everything diving, tech diving, and especially the benefits of diving with disabilities. Today, I'm very pleased to have on a gentleman that I happened to stumble across on the internet when I was looking for diving stuff for the podcast. And his name is Dom Robinson from the UK. And this guy actually bought a World War I shipwreck. So how's it going, Dom?
Yeah, it's really good. Clearly, that story has gone mad. It's been amazing how much interest there has been in it.
Well, I guess because, I mean, I had heard briefly, I didn't know until a couple of weeks ago that you could actually own a shipwreck in Europe that was a British shipwreck. But then to find somebody that actually recently bought one on Facebook of all places, that would be the last place that I would think about looking to find a shipwreck to buy, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't looking to buy a shipwreck when I was on there. But, you know, like all these things, it served the algorithm and it kind of figured out I'd probably be interested in one, and it kind of showed it to me. And, you know what? It was right. I was interested in buying one. So I bought one. I guess it's what probably people don't know is that during the two world wars, all the commercial ships that were sunk, and the insurance companies wouldn't pay out for them because obviously it's wartime. So the governments stepped in and they covered the insurance bill for the shipwrecks. And on the back of that, the governments ended up owning, you know, the shipwrecks. Now, obviously, they couldn't do anything with them. So what they tended to do was they sold them for salvage. And so people, until probably about 30 years ago in this country, you could buy a shipwreck from the government and they'd sell it to you. And then people would often, you know, salvage bits and pieces off it. So the shipwreck that I got was bought by a guy in 1978, and he kept it and did nothing with it. And I think he was kind of like everyone does it every now and again. You go through your, your wardrobe or whatever, and you go, oh, I don't need this. I don't need this anymore. What am I keeping that piece of junk for? And he thought, oh, I've got this shipwreck that I don't need anymore. And it's like, well, I want to get rid of it. And it's like, where do you sell a shipwreck? I don't know. I don't know if you were buying one where you'd go, but he thought Facebook Marketplace was the place.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. I mean, I never in a million years would I have figured of looking on Facebook for, well, I mean, mind you, if all kinds of people are hawking treasure coins and stuff like that on there. So
yeah, it's just another thing. So, you know, I saw it was on there and I had always fancied owning a shipwreck. I'd actually tried to buy one before off the government. I actually know another guy who owns a shipwreck. I tried to buy his and he wouldn't sell it. The government wouldn't sell it either. So I saw this one. I was like, oh yeah, this is my moment. I have to have this. So I was in there like a shot. And you know what? I've bought various bits and pieces off Facebook Marketplace. I'm sure we all have. And what I can tell you, this was one of the easiest things I've ever bought off there. There was no messing around. There was no kicking tires. There was no arguments or anything like that. I never even met the guy. I sent him some money. He sent me a thing saying I owned the shipwreck, and that was that.
Oh, wow. So it's that easy to switch a shipwreck ownership.
So it would seem. But I sent him the contract to, we have this guy in the UK called the Receiver of Wreck, whose job it is to do all sorts of things. But one of the things he does is he looks after this sort of stuff. And he got back to me and said, yeah, Dom, I confirm you own the wreck of the Almond Branch. So forevermore, I am the legal owner to the title. So, should I ever wish to do anything with it? You know, I can do.
Now, so that gets to my next question, because I don't know if you've read my bio there or not, but I used to do some treasure diving. So when it comes to shipwrecks, I have sort of a torn thing. Yes, if it says it's protected, I will leave it. However, if it was on a wreck that I was legally allowed to remove stuff off of, I would be in there like a dirty shirt, probably.
So if you have a look behind me, most of the plates and stuff on the shelf behind me, these have all come off shipwrecks. So, and the rules in the UK are relatively clear. So if you find something on a shipwreck and you bring it up, what you have to do is you have to declare it to this this chap, the Receiver of Wreck. And the Receiver of Wreck, what he does is he decides who owns it. And if he can't find an owner, often he will grant you, the person who brought it up, he will grant you ownership of it. If he can find the owner, then what happens is if the owner wants it back, they have to pay your costs for the salvage. So, you then have a negotiation process. So now, for instance, my shipwreck, if someone were to go down there, Curtis, and you were to go down and you were to find, let's say, the bell, because the bell's never come off it, and you were to bring the bell up, that's absolutely fine. What you'd have to do is declare it to the Receiver of Wreck, who would then come to me and say, this gentleman has found the bell, do you want it? And I would then go, ooh, how much were your salvage costs? And because you're a reasonable man, you would say to me, that was £200 or whatever it was. And I would go, yeah, no worries. Here's £200. And you would hand that over to me and we'd all be good. And that's the way it's supposed to work.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you, if I were to bring up a ship bill, my negotiating price would not be £200 to get the ship bill.
So this is the thing. I found three bells during my diving career. One of them is outside my house. So that was a wreck that was owned by the government. I declared it to the Receiver of Wreck. The Receiver of Wreck said the government's not interested in it, so you can have it in lieu of salvage, which is the proper term. So I've got my bell from a wreck called the Silver Laurel. And I found two other bells. The other bell I found was on the ship with a kind of a name that's not very politically correct. And you certainly wouldn't call a ship that these days. I found the bell of the HMS Negro, which was sunk in the First World War. And I left the bell down there. It's off the north coast of Scotland. And anybody who wants to find out about these things, by the way, they're all on my YouTube channel, so you can go and have a look at it. And you can see me finding the bell of that one. And there's another bell that I found more recently that I can't actually talk about yet, but I should be able to do in the next few weeks.
Today I got to get you back again to find out what this other bell is.
Well, I'm hoping it should be out pretty soon. So I expect you'll be on the news again.
Cool. Is it another wartime ship?
It is indeed another wartime ship. And obviously, being Canadian, you'll be very interested in it.
Really? All right. Now, yeah, now you definitely have my interest piqued.
So more to follow on that one, I think, but I can't say any more, I'm afraid.
All right, well, fair enough. I get it. You got to keep the secret. So, all right. So, I'll
It's
make sure I keep it on my contact list,
but obviously finding bells is what divers dream about, isn't it? It's the kind of thing. The other bell that I was part of a buddy team that found a bell. I didn't actually find it. The guy I was with found it on a wreck called the United States ship Jacob Jones, which was the first American destroyer sunk by enemy action. It was sunk in December 1917, right off kind of the south coast of Ireland, west coast of England. And 60 odd Americans lost their lives on it, and we found it 3 years ago in 115 meters of water. We went down there. We could see the bell. We could see the name, a bit of the name Jacob Jones. It was what we were looking for. Absolutely brilliant feeling. We left it down there, and the Royal Navy went back and recovered it about 15 or 16 months ago. Handed over to the Americans. And it's on its way back to the States, I believe.
Wow, that's very cool. So, how long have you been into scuba diving and progressed? Are you actually a professional, full-time professional diver?
I have been, but I'm not at the moment. So I started diving when I was a kid. My dad took me when we lived in Papua New Guinea in the tropics. Chucked a load of gear on, and we jumped in and went for a dive, which was great. And then when I joined the military, I was in the army. I learned to do recreational diving through the Adventurous Training System, and then kind of progressed from there. And then when I left the military, I actually worked for as a civil servant for the military, teaching other people to scuba dive. So that was when I was full time employed as a kind of diver. But I don't do that anymore. I kind of moved on to other things. But this sort of stuff. This technical diving, the kind of stuff that I put on my YouTube channel, that's my hobby. So, it's what I get up to at weekend. So I'm off tomorrow.
Wow, cool. So where are you off to tomorrow? Or is that a secret location again?
No secrets from tomorrow. The weather's not too good. So we've got a kind of our, not quite house reef, but our kind of house wreck is like a 53, 54 meter dive. It's a ship that was sunk in the Second World War called the Medoc. It was operated by the French, the Free French, and was sunk by a German torpedo bomber. But it's a lovely dive. It's covered in ammunitions, loads of shell cases down there, and it's just a really nice dive actually. So probably going to do that tomorrow because it's a bit windy.
Now, are you able to, on that wreck, are you allowed to retrieve stuff?
So yeah, that wreck isn't protected in any way. So if you want to bring stuff up, you're more than welcome. So there's bits and pieces down there. So people occasionally bring up shell cases. People sometimes bring up portholes and that kind of stuff. But there's not much left because it's the one that's done quite often. So a lot of stuff has gone. And obviously, if you bring it up, you've got to declare it, like I've explained.
How much of a hassle is it to when you have to declare it? Like, is it a lot of like paperwork and stuff like that to go through? Because I imagine that would be a deterrent for some people just right there thinking, oh, this is going to be a headache.
Yeah, no, I mean it's like these days, obviously everything's online, isn't it? So there's an online form you've got to do. You say where you found it, and put a photo of it and everything. It's actually quite a good process. Historically, it's been a problem in the UK. People would put these things in, and what they're meant to happen is after 12 months, there's meant to be a decision, an outcome, and the department that did it got so bogged down with these things that for years and years and years, no, they were never closed. There's a new receiver of wreck who's come in who's made it his mission to close as many of these things as possible. So people are seeing them done a lot more efficiently now, which is great news because, like you say, people are more likely to follow the process if they think it works.
Oh yeah, absolutely. So you got, is it like, how long does it take you to, from the time you like fill it out and then generally before you get the okay back that, okay, this is your item now or whatever?
Yeah, kind of. It depends. I mean, it can be really quick within you know 2 months or something like that. Sometimes it can take a lot longer. So my bell, for instance, I recovered about 5 years ago. It was when they had the backlog, and it was about a year and a half ago, maybe, that I got the confirmation that it was mine. But obviously, that was, you know, it was nice because it's all done properly and legally and everything, and nobody can ever argue about whether I own that bell or not. It's definitely mine.
Yep. Yeah, no, that's definitely a huge advantage. I mean, here, I know if you go removing stuff off wrecks in Ontario, it's like, yeah, you're in big trouble.
I think it's the same in lots of countries. I think our laws on this are quite old. So they were, you know, back from the days, you know, you read the terminology and it's really old terminology. And I think it's just been like that ever since. Whereas I think if you were starting from scratch now, what you would probably do is probably end up with a law similar to the one that you've got.
I agree on that for sure. So what other types of projects have you been involved in? You do a lot of rebreather diving mostly, yeah, right?
Yeah, so I'm pretty much 100% rebreather these days. So I pretty much all my diving is probably deeper than 50, 55 meters. I probably do 60 gas dives a year, 55 to 60 gas dives a year, sort of. And then
with the state of today's economy, it's more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made from the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back in your local community. Choosing American Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality, made-to-last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
That's just because that's what, you know, flicks my boat these days. And I'm really lucky in that, you know, I know lots of people who do it, and I'm in a really good part of the United Kingdom to be able to do this kind of stuff. I'm right in the southwest, and we're very fortunate here. We've got easy access to the sea. We've got a ton of diving down here. So, and the visibility is good by British standards. And yeah, so, I'm in a really good position. And to be honest, I'll be absolutely fair here. Some of the diving we do can be have pretty good vis by anybody's standards. So, So, you know, I've had 30 meters visibility at 80 meters in the middle of the English Channel, which is perhaps not what you might expect.
No, I wouldn't have expected that, actually.
Yeah. So what I would say to people, if you want to, you know, people have this, particularly who aren't from the UK, have this view on what British diving is like. What I would say to people is go and have a look at my YouTube channel, have a look at some of the videos that I put out there, and you will see some absolutely stunning diving. In fact, what I've done is a bit provocative. I made a video that said why I think Plymouth, which is where I live, is the best place for deep wreck diving in the UK. And I've also said, and possibly the world. And so if people, loads of people disagree with that, of course they will. They'll think like Truk or Bikini or the Caribbean or something like that. Yeah, but what they're doing is they're kind of not really understanding how I framed the question. So they should go and watch that video, and they will see why I think it's so good.
I'll have to check it out. I mean, I definitely would enjoy it because I'm into all the historical shipwrecks, and especially World War I and World War II stuff, especially. So I would definitely be into living there as far as that goes. My stepdaughter, actually, and her husband, he's from England, and they're actually moving back to England. So I'm fortunate in that way because I'm probably going to get to do some diving over in the UK at some point now. So,
well, you should definitely do that. And if you're ever down this way, drop us a line, and I'll kind of, you know, be good to meet up, and I'll give you a few pointers.
Oh, absolutely. No, I'd love to go for a dive with you over there. So I'm not into doing rebreathers. I'm going to be trying a rebreather later on this year at some point. Cost wise for one thing. Stuff. So we'll see how that goes. But I mean, the price of mixed gas for doing any type of deep diving is exactly why you dive rebreathers.
Yeah, for certain. So open circuit trimix is basically dead, as far as I can tell. You know, and certainly for the kind of stuff that we do, you know, you might use trimix for a kind of one or two dives a year to 50 meters or whatever. But for anything that's kind of, you know, beyond that, you know, the cost is just absolutely exorbitant. So yeah, you know, rebreathers are where it's at, I'm afraid, for this kind of diving.
Yep, which I mean, it is. I mean, I guess the other thing I have with rebreathers that concerns me is the safety factor of it, because there is a lot more deaths that occur on rebreathers than on open circuit scuba, for sure. So
yeah, I mean, there's no doubt about it. It's they're more complex things, and you know, they're more capable, and therefore with that goes, it's not necessarily the rebreather that ever kills somebody. It's normally the thing that's sitting inside the rebreather that makes some poor choices. And that's what bites them. So, you know, with diving a rebreather comes, you know, requirement for you to kind of maintain skills and, you know, stay on top of your kit maintenance and, you know, and get trained properly in the first place. And to, you know, frankly, to make sensible decisions. So, I mean, one of the other things I've done, and I don't know if you've seen it, is I did a bailout last year. So on a sort of 70-meter dive, I basically, my rebreather was filling full of water, and I had a video of it. So I've done my rebreather bailout video, and all the way through, I talk through my decision making and everything. So I stay on the rebreather for quite a long period of time, and then as I'm making my scent, actually I end up bailing out. But I talk through the full sequence, and you know, it's, once again, a lot of people have put lots of comments on it on my YouTube, and you know, people ask me questions about it and everything. So it's really interesting. I think lots of people found it useful as well, to kind of, because I don't think there's much of that kind of material out there. So hopefully it'll help other people with their kind of decision making if they're into being in that sort of situation.
Yeah, I definitely am going to check that out. Actually, yesterday it was funny because I was interviewing Michael Manduno on yesterday.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I was interviewing him, and I mean, let's face it, he's the godfather of tech diving and rebreathers and all that stuff, basically. So him and me actually talk about rebreathers quite a bit, because I, back in the 90s when I was a professional diver, and then before I got out of it, I mean, back then, unless you were in military or unless you had a real rich buddy that you could steal one from, you weren't getting a rebreather.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the things that we've seen happen is obviously they've actually, cost-wise, they've come down quite significantly. I don't know what it's like in Canada, but certainly in the UK, you can buy a second-hand, you know, fairly good quality rebreather for somewhere in the region of £3,000 to £4,000, you know, which is not a huge sum of money, you know, when you compare to other things that people, you know, do for hobbies. So I used to ride motorbikes, for instance, and, you know, yeah. I mean, it's much more, you know, reasonably priced, and, you know, and because of that, I think you start to see, certainly in the UK anyway, I can't speak for other places, but you're seeing rebreathers come more and more into recreational diving. So where once upon a time it always used to be twin sets, now lots of people are doing, you know, kind of 30 to 40 meter dives on rebreathers as well. So it's really interesting to see that happen.
Yeah, I've actually been shocked. I started diving again back in November 2023, and I have been shocked at that was one of the things that surprised me the most, is how much technical diving and rebreathers and stuff have become a lot more mainstream. I used to be a paddy instructor. I would never in a million years back then would have ever thought that I would ever see Patty offering a rebreather course.
Yeah, I mean, they're all doing it now, aren't they? They've all, you know, it's the demand is there, and you see it, you know, particularly amongst younger divers. I would say, you know, lots of younger people, they have a, you know, they get into diving, they look around, they're like, right, okay, you know, where do I go next? And, you know, they want that progression, don't they? They want to move on to the next thing. And, you know, it is a, you know, there's a fairly clear logic. You know, you kind of, you go single, twin set, rebreather, don't you? Although, you know, maybe via side mount or something like that. But, you know, I think you start to see people just go single rebreather, you know, and they just kind of almost miss out the twin set phase.
Yeah, I'm actually being certified doing my side mount course next weekend for side mount diving.
Yeah,
trying that. Yeah. I'm doing it. Well, I am getting into doing technical diving, but the main reason I'm doing it is because of my leg issues I have with my legs and just making it easier to get in and out of the water, because unless I do a charter up here, everything that's a shore dive is all rocky crap.
Yeah, no, it must be a real challenge, you know, shore diving, you know, with disability, you know, with a disability like yours, must be really challenging. And side mount, I can absolutely see why that makes sense for your circumstances. So yeah, I mean, I've seen other people with, you know, similar kind of issues to your own who have done exactly the same thing.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. It should be pretty good. It's funny because I actually have four of my friends that I met last year. They're all either three of them are side mount certified now, and I have another one that's also gang certified. So there's going to be like four or five of us in the area that all side mount dive.
Excellent. Well, that's good because you know, it makes sense to dive with people in a similar configuration to you anyway, doesn't it? You understand each other's gear, your run times are about the same, you know, you can help each other out and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Those guys are mainly doing it, I think. Well, a couple of the guys are doing it because of, like me, old age and, you know, getting busted up and more sore. And then, so yeah, I think we're more doing it that than the tech aspect of it from it, but it is going to be a lot of fun to do it.
Yeah, I mean, they add safety benefits as well, don't they, having a completely second independent gas source and all that kind of stuff. I mean, it's interesting, you see the way different people adapt to cope with different changes in their life. So one of the guys I dive with who does a lot of photography is, you know, he's in his kind of mid-60s, and rather than trying to carry around two Ali 80s, which is really difficult if you're on a moving boat or trying to get out of the water or anything, he's gone, you know what, sod that. And he's bought carbon 7-liter 300 bar cylinders, which are much, much lighter, obviously, out of the water. Have got really nice buoyancy characteristics in the water. And you've got the same amount of gas as an Ali 80. So it's a really sensible solution for him to that particular problem. Fortunately, he's a retired dentist, so he's okay for a few bob, which means that he can afford it, because that's the problem for the rest of us.
Yeah, it all adds up. I mean, I know that's one of the things several of my friends joke about, is the fact that's why they don't go to a rebreather, because the divorce would cost them too much. It's not the cost of the rebreather that would kill them. It's the cost of the divorce and everything else that goes along with it.
Yeah, for certain.
So are you married by chance?
I am married. I've got a very lovely wife. She's very understanding of my kind of oddities, such as, you know, buying a shipwreck and everything. Her only criteria is it doesn't end up in the garden. So you know, that's
other than that. What was her first response when you came home and said, "Hey, honey, I bought a shipwreck"?
The first response was, anybody who's been married for a while will recognize the roll of the eyes. And then the that was then followed by the make sure it doesn't end up in the garden, leave it at the bottom of the sea. What she's ended up being really annoyed by, I think, is the coverage of it all, because, you know, any number of her friends have said, "Hey, I've seen Dom on the news about buying this shipwreck and everything," and she's like, "I'm sick of that blooming thing."
Yeah, which is kind of funny. I mean, actually, it was when I was talking to my wife yesterday and mentioning that I was going to be interviewing you. At first, she just like woken up and she'd been working on nights. And I said, I'm interviewing this guy, bought a shipwreck off Facebook. And she had not paying half paying attention and said, you bought a shipwreck off Facebook? And she actually, I mean, in my own defense, yeah, there would be a possibility of that if I had a chance to do it, probably. So
yeah, well, it wouldn't, you know, what's not to like? If you had the opportunity, why, you know, everybody would, I'm sure. That's why I bought it really quickly, because I knew somebody else would get in there if I didn't.
So was there by chance any like safes or anything on this wreck that you haven't possibly located yet? Because that would be my first thing if I was going for a wreck. Okay, what potentially is on this sucker?
Ah, no. So it was a kind of a tramp steamer, really. It was, I've dived it before, I owned it. So I knew there wasn't much of any value on there. The, it's mainly inverted as well, actually. So quite a lot of it's upside down. So to be honest, it sounds a lot better than it actually is. And obviously the bell's not being found, so I would like to find that, but it's almost certainly it's got most of a shipwreck on top of it. The other thing with it is the stern is not quite inverted. There's a gun mount there for this, because it was defensively armed in the First World War. They stuck guns on lots of ships to submarines. But so the mount for the gun is there, but and there's some ammunition for the gun there. There's no gun. So I was like, that's a bit odd. Where is the gun? Now, back in the day, they did used to lift guns off shipwrecks, and they would take them back, and they would take them in, and they would obviously made a fairly decent quality steel, so they'd sell them for scrap. They're worth some money. So I thought maybe that was what happened. But I got once I put my video out, I got some, and I asked the question on the video, what happened to the gun? So a guy got in touch with me and said, yeah, you're absolutely right. What happened in the 1970s was a load of guys with a fishing boat went out there and they lifted the gun and they strapped the gun, I think, either to the side or to the bottom of the fishing boat. And they were taking the fishing boat back into port. And when they were on the way back into port, somewhere on the way, the gun fell off. So somewhere in the middle of the sea, there is the gun of my shipwreck.
Oh, I knew as soon as you said that they were towing it back in, I knew that's what was coming next.
Yeah.
And is that the only gun that happened to be on the ship?
Yeah, no, there's only one on the, there's only one, it's on the stern, it's gone. I mean, there's loads of shipwrecks around here I've done, so we're quite used to seeing them.
Yeah, that's true. But that would have been something that, had I owned a shipwreck and there was a gun on it, I would have brought the gun up. I mean, what would your wife think of you having a gun off the shipwreck on your lawn?
Hey, everybody. Thanks for watching. Please remember to like, share, and subscribe. And by the way, we're also on your favorite podcast platforms now. We are on Amazon. We are on Spotify. We are on iHeartRadio. We are on Player FM. And Podchaser, all of the descriptions are going to be down below, so make sure you check us out. Thanks, have a great day, and remember, grab an adventure and live.
Oh, she would be pleased. She would be so happy. I can tell you that right now. Which wife wouldn't be? What I might do is hang it in the kitchen or something like that. I'll bring it in the kitchen. That would be even better, I reckon.
Hey, I've done all kinds of stuff like that. I mean, when I used to race dirt bikes, I literally have had dirt bikes in the kitchen. I've had dirt bikes in the living room. I've had, you name it. So what's the difference? Actually, it's better because you're looking at something of nice historical factor there. You know, you could always have that argument with, at least instead of it being a hot rod or something. I would think that would be little bit easier to justify your case.
Yeah, I just don't. Wives just are not happy with whatever husbands do, are they, by and large? I'm lucky mine's pretty tolerant. She just doesn't want it in the house.
I cannot say that. I am very lucky. My wife is fully supportive behind me doing all this crazy shit and helps me do it. So I'm very lucky that way.
Well done. You've chosen well. Or maybe she chose well. Who knows?
Yeah, I don't know about whether she chose well or not. But so what other kind of cool dive projects do you have coming up? Do you plan on buying any more shipwrecks?
To be honest, if I saw another one for sale, I would absolutely buy it. So if anybody out there has got a shipwreck they don't want, you should definitely drop me a line and I would I'll probably take it off you. But no more shipwrecks. What are we doing? We're going to look for something called the United States Coast Guard vessel Tampa. So it's another First World War casualty. It's another lost ship. We've been looking for it for about 3 years. Off the it's sunk off the kind of north coast of Cornwall, so in between Cornwall and the southern coast of Ireland. We've done probably 15, maybe 20 dives looking for it, and we've not managed to find it. Anyway, we're going out again in about a week and a half, and the people who are organising it, they're really confident that they've got the right mark this time. So fingers crossed we could find it. So if we did find it, that would be a really big news story.
Wow. And you've been looking at that for 5 years.
Three to four, I would say. Yeah. But we've dived about 15 different targets trying to find it. So, and we found lots of other interesting things. So, once again, if people, you know, want to look on my channel, you see, we found a landing craft tank. So, like, I don't know, 70 meters long, it could carry between 4 and 6 Sherman tanks. It sunk in the Second World War. In fact, there was a whole convoy of them. Incredibly tragic story. 50 guys lost their lives. They lost five of these things. Nobody's ever heard of it. And we were diving looking for the Tampa, and we found one of these things. Absolutely, it was incredible. It took us ages to figure out what it was. But yeah, really, really kind of nice once again to kind of, you know, close that particular story off. But yeah, and we found loads of other stuff while we've been looking for the Tampa as well. But what we've not done is we've not found the Tampa. So fingers crossed, this will be it.
That's awesome. I mean, I'm going to have a link to your YouTube channel down below here so that everybody can check it out and all the cool stuff that you've been finding. So what of all of these shipwrecks that you've been diving over there and for looking for, what would you say is the most historical or most one that you're okay, this is the cool one out of all of them, and why?
Okay. Yeah, so I've probably got to go with HMS Victory. Now, HMS Victory might not be a name that means very much to Canadians, but it's a name that means a lot to British people. It was the flagship on which Nelson defeated the French at the Battle of Trafalgar. And that particular ship is still in Portsmouth and is kept afloat. And it's the oldest ship in continuous service. So it's a really important ship. Now, that wasn't the first ship to be called HMS Victory. It was probably about the fourth or the fifth. Now, the one before it was about the same size and was lost in a storm in 1744. 1,100 sailors died when basically it vanished in this storm. So it's the single biggest Royal Navy loss in the English Channel. And you think about the English Channel, obviously the Navy have lost quite a lot of guys in there over the years. So the wreck was missing for nearly 300 years until it was found by a salvage company called Odyssey Marine. And it's about 45 miles south of here. Only a very small number of people have dived it, and I've had the privilege of diving it twice. It's a wooden ship. It's covered. The wreck site had 100 bronze cannons on there. Some of these things are 3.5 meters long, so they are unbelievable things to see underwater. You can see the crest on them. King George I, who was one of our German kings. There's loads and loads of them down there. There's all sorts of shenanigans going on with it as well, because a load of the cannon aren't in their original places. They've got lifting strops on and stuff, so people have been moving around and all sorts of stuff. So as somebody who's been a treasure hunter, you'll obviously know about bronze cannon. Yeah. supposedly, there's a big pile of gold somewhere on the wreck as well. What I don't know about the gold, but what I can say for certain, there are bones on there. So there's bones, you know, nearly 300-year-old sailors, you know, their bones are on that wreck site. So once again, that video is on my YouTube channel. It's an unbelievable dive. And, you know, if you want to see something really historically significant, that's the one to go and have a look at.
How deep is that one?
That's 78 meters. So you're probably, it's a decent rebreather dive.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah, that's amazing. No, talking about the treasure hunting stuff and the cannons. Actually, I worked for Mel Fisher back in the 90s.
Oh, wow.
For a while. And the coolest thing I have ever done any time diving, period, was the day we actually brought up a cannon from the 1733 fleet. And I have handled all kinds of Spanish treasure. I have handled gold bars. I've handled 90-pound silver bars. I've handled gold crosses with emeralds and rubies in them. And let me tell you, bringing up the cannon was the coolest thing I've ever done.
Yeah. And I absolutely get that. They are unbelievably beautiful objects and, you know, incredible things. And as I say, to see this wreck site where they are literally everywhere is absolutely incredible. But I mean, the stuff that you've done there, the Mel Fisher, and was that on the Acosha or something like that, was it?
I worked in the conservation lab for a while with Sid Jones. I've actually interviewed him and his wife on my podcast. And so I worked in the conservation lab with them. And then I did some diving with Kane on the 1733 and 1715 fleet.
Wow. So, that is what a fantastic thing to do.
It is. So that's where I get my bug from treasure diving in, where I'm torn on whether I would bring stuff up or not.
Yeah. So I've never really found anything truly valuable in terms of, you know, monetary value. I guess it's probably the one thing I've got. Just give us 2 secs. I'll bring this down here. And I don't know if you can see that.
Oh, that's a white star.
Yeah. So that's the white star line, which is obviously the Titanic line. The Titanic had exactly the same plates as this on board when it sunk. This is off another white star line wreck called the SS Afrique, which is off here in Plymouth. And I've got several of these plates now. If you have a look for them on eBay or whatever, you'll find that they go for a reasonable amount of money, not kind of gold bullion type money, but they're still relatively valuable. So you know, I'm not going to drop it, but it's quite a nice thing to have.
That would be one thing that I would love to have in my podcast studio / office. One of those.
Yeah.
So no, that's really cool. So how many dives have you done on that wreck?
I don't know, probably 5 or 6, maybe a few more. It was owned by the White Star Line, but it was a third class ship. It did the route from the UK to Australia and was coming back and was sunk by a torpedo March 1917, as so many other ships were. But if you want one that is you know, perhaps valuable, there's another liner a bit further around the coast called the Medina, which was a first-class P&O liner that was coming back from India and bringing back the Viceroy of India on board it, who had a load of treasure. So he'd done his time down there. He was coming home, got torpedoed again, and it all, you know, obviously went to the bottom of the sea. So in the 1980s, they sent down a salvage team onto the wreck with a bell. And they kind of cut their way inside, got to the cargo hold where all this stuff was, got all this stuff out, and then they obviously conserved it and everything. And they took it to Christie's, which is a famous UK auction house, and sold it all off at Christie's. So there was you know, all sorts of kind of ivory stuff, and I think there was a bit of gold and all that kind of stuff. And unfortunately, there's none of that left on the wreck. But what there is there's loads of kind of cutlery. It's got really nice fittings on board it. You know, once again, you'll see on my channel, I go into the dining room in there, and you can see me kind of swimming around in the dining room, and there's all the chairs and the tables there and everything. And it's just really, really nice wreck. 50 meters to the top of it, 60 meters to the bottom. But because you can get inside it and swim around in it, it's particularly nice.
Wow, that's cool. So with diving that wreck, like when you brought up the plates, you have to declare those, obviously, right?
Yeah, for certain. So the that one there, the Afrique one, a guy bought that once again in the 70s. So that wreck is owned by a bloke who lives about a mile away from here, and so he owns the whole thing. He's got it had three bells. He's got one of the bells in his garden. It's absolutely massive. And so, you know, I reported my plates to the receiver of rec. Receiver of rec got in touch with him, and he said, you know what, I don't need any more plates off the Afrique. So he's given me, you know, legally that plate there is absolutely mine. It has provenance and all that kind of stuff. So anybody out there wants to make me a good offer on a Titanic plate, you know, I might be listening. I might be willing to listen to offers. There we go.
I'd be afraid to ask how much they go for roughly. How much do they go for roughly on eBay? I haven't looked one up.
I reckon they're about £1,000 UK.
Ooh, yeah, okay, so $2,000. Yeah, no.
Yeah, but to be honest, all the dives I've done on it and all that kind of stuff, I've probably spent that amount of money to get one out anyway.
Oh yeah, that plate probably cost you a lot more money than $2,000 by the time you figure everything into it. And then when you figure in your training and your equipment and...
yeah. Nobody's doing this to make money, are they?
No. No, even professionals don't do it to make a lot of money.
Yeah, I mean, you know the famous joke about how you make a small fortune in the dive industry?
No.
You start off with a big fortune.
Yeah, that is true.
So, yeah.
Unless you get off lucky and get one of these massive shipwrecks like the company you were talking about earlier. What's the name of them? The big salvage.
Odyssey went bust though, didn't they? They, I think a legal case. I can't remember which shipwreck it was, but they went bust over a legal case. So they're gone. In fact, the thing that I told you about the Medina, the one where they auctioned all the stuff off at Christie's, that ended up making a loss as well, and all the people who'd invested in it, you know, took a haircut and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, salvage. Unless you're Mel Fisher, I think you're probably pretty stuffed.
Yeah, I know. Everybody ends up taking a bath or taking a legal hit by all the legal proceedings they end up getting drawn into and stuff like that. So I know a guy here who had a similar situation where he found a wreck and they pulled a bunch of stuff off of it to keep it protected and stuff. And the legal battle that ensued and everything was ridiculous. So... And I mean, let's face it, most people do not have as good of a lawyer as what Mel Fisher had, David Horan, his lawyer, because I mean, that guy was, I actually got to meet him when I worked there. I met him once and that guy was badass. He had gone to, at that time, he had gone to court, I think 111 or 112 times and beat the government every single time. So... If you're going for a shipwreck, he's the guy that you would have wanted fighting for you for sure.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining me today, Dom, on the Deadfoot Diver podcast. It has been awesome talking to you about this and how you bought this amazing shipwreck. And I look forward to having you back again sometime, hopefully, and talk to you about some more of your adventures.
Yeah, lovely. Well, thanks for the invite. And you know, fingers crossed I'll be back. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And thanks, everybody, for watching. Have a great day. And remember, grab an adventure and live.